Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and let's see, I think it's a Thursday, and it is December 4th. So let's take a look at the schedule on the right-hand side. December 4th, we're going to get into renal physiology, hopefully finish up respiratory physiology, get into renal physiology, and then next week we're going to talk a little bit about the diversification system. And 1 week from today is your last exam. And the chapters on that, make sure you modify your syllabus right here, because what are the chapters? They're different than what it shows right here. It starts with chapter 13. Yeah, 13, 14, 16, 17, and 20. Okay, so that's what's going to be on the last exam. It's not cumulative. It's just over those chapters. And then next week, I'll also have another drawing and lab to do for you guys, which is the hormone profiles, the uterine cycle and ovarian cycle, and some hormones that are involved in controlling those. All right, so last time we were talking about respiration. Anybody have any questions over what we talked about last time? Questions? All right, I guess we were talking about the pleural cavity and some membranes inside the pleural cavity. Who can tell me something about membranes of the pleural cavity? First, tell me what kind of space is it. Is it open to the outside world or not open to the outside world? The pleural cavity is not open to the outside world. So what kind of membrane lines a cavity that's not open to the outside world? Yeah, serous, right, a serous membrane. And serous membrane is a little bit more complicated than the standard mucous membrane because it's got three parts, right? And so you got to know those three parts. The part that's right on the surface of the lung is called the visceral pleura, right? Because the lung is a visceral organ. It's inside a cavity that's not open to the outside world. And then that membrane is continuous. It folds around and eventually ends up on the wall of the thoracic cavity. And then we call that the parietal division of the pleural membrane, or parietal pleura. And since it's a serous membrane, there's a space between these two. Right, so these membranes are very much the same, but they're in different locations so that they have a different name. And what kind of fluid do we have in this space between the visceral and parietal pleura? That's the pleural space filled with serous fluid or pleural fluid. Right, and the physical properties of that are completely different compared to the lining of an alveolus. Remember, the lining of an alveolus has surfactant in it, which kind of breaks the surface tension so that these alveoli can expand. Right, but the fluid in this serous space is very watery, so it's sticky. And as a matter of fact, it helps glue the wall, the visceral division and the parietal division of the pleural membranes together. And so it's really not even a space. It's a potential space because that water really glues these two things together. So that when the rib cage or thoracic, when the thorax expands, right, it pulls on the surface of the lung and it helps expand the lungs as well, okay? Because these two membranes are glued to each other very nicely. Okay, I think that's about the last thing that we looked at. All right, so that's a sticky kind of lubricating fluid, water. It doesn't have surfactant in it. All right, so how is it that we change, how is it that the lungs stay glued to the wall besides water? There's another reason why, that the surface of the lung stays very in close contact with the walls of the thorax, right? And it has to do with pressures that are inside the lung and pressures that are in that space between the visceral and parietal divisions of that serous membrane. All right, so during inspiration, the intrapulmonary pressure is about -3 millimeters of mercury, and during expiration, it's about +3 millimeters of mercury. So what is this intrapulmonary pressure? Where's intrapulmonary? That is inside the lungs, right? So intrapulmonary is pressure inside the lungs, and during inspiration, we say it's -3. That's compared to atmospheric pressure. And atmospheric pressure is measured in millimeters of mercury as well. Right? And so if this is lower pressure than atmosphere, what's going to happen to air? Because air is just a fluid. Now it's low inside the lungs, it's high in the room, which way is this fluid going to move? Which way is air going to move? From high pressure to low pressure. Low pressure is in the lungs, so air is going to flow into the lungs when that happens. Right, during expiration, because there's changes in the volume of our thoracic cavity, the pressure now goes from -3 to +3, and that's above atmospheric pressure. So now there's higher pressure in the lungs compared to the air, and air flows out of the lungs as a result of that. All right, but what about the intrapleural? Where's the intrapleural space? Here's the intrapleural space, right? We want to look and see what are the forces that are causing this lung to collapse or to expand, right? To expand and stay in contact with the wall of the thorax. So we want to look at that intrapleural pressure. The intrapleural pressure, what do we have? Oh, right here. During inspiration, it's -6 millimeters of mercury. And on expiration, right, it doesn't go positive, it stays negative, -3 millimeters of mercury. All right, so we want to look at what is the pressure difference across the wall of the lungs, right? And sometimes we call that the transmural pressure, right? Transmural just means across the wall of something. Like if we want to look at the transmural biochemistry of the heart, we would look at what's happening across the wall of the heart. So transmural just means across the wall. So we want to look at the pressure across the wall of the lungs to see if it's going to help expand the lungs or shrink the lungs down. And that's also called the transpulmonary pressure, transmural or transpulmonary, right? It's across the wall of the lung. And since we know these two pressures, if we subtract them from each other, right, the intrapleural minus the intrapulmonary, then we can figure out what the transpulmonary pressure is. And that's what you see on this table. All right, so if we go intrapulmonary, -3, and subtract the intrapleural pressure, which is -6, right, then we see that the transpulmonary pressure, or pressure across the wall of the lung, is +3 millimeters of mercury, which is shoving the lung out up against the wall of the thorax during inspiration. Right, and even during expiration, right? During expiration, the intrapulmonary pressure is +3. The intrapleural, it goes up compared to inspiration, but it still is a -3. And if we subtract these two, we get a +6. All right, so these plus numbers here means that the wall of the lung is going to be pushed up against the wall of the thorax. So the wall of the lung is going to stay in contact with the wall of the thorax. Doesn't matter if it's inspiration or expiration. That's going to keep the lungs inflated, right? But there is something that is going to try to collapse the lungs all the time, and that I tried to do an experiment last time, but it blew up in my face. Okay, what is collapsing the lung all the time? I think we did an experiment on the paper bag versus the balloon. Remember that? I tried to do the balloon, but it blew up. I was going to ask you, what is a better model of an alveolus, that paper bag or the balloon? And it was really obvious to everyone because you said balloon. Yeah, because the balloon is very elastic, right? If we blow the balloon up and just let it go, it's going to collapse by itself because of elasticity, right? Same thing for the whole lung. If we just let it go, it's going to collapse by itself, right? But because of this transmural pressure right here, right, it defeats that collapsing of the lung. Right? But if for some reason, if there is a hole in somebody's chest, so the pressure, the intrapulmonary pressure and intrapleural pressure are the same if somebody gets a puncture wound of the thorax, right? So the pressure is exactly the same. There is no pressure expanding the lungs, but the lung still has that elastic tissue. What's going to happen to this lung right here? It's going to collapse, right? And it won't be able to inflate, right? You can change the size of the thorax, but air is just going to move in and out of this intrapleural space, and the elastic properties of the lung will keep it deflated. And that's what we call a pneumothorax. That's a pneumothorax when that happens. Okay. All right, so that's something about those different kinds of pressure. So when you read your text, just remember, your textbook uses transmural and transpulmonary interchangeably. It's a little confusing, at least for me. All right, let's talk about Boyle's Law. And Boyle's Law describes very nicely why air moves in and out of our lungs. And Boyle's Law just says that pressure is related to volume in what sense? How would you talk about this mathematically very nicely? What's the relationship? Yeah, it's inversely related, right? And as opposed to directly related, your book uses a little bit different terminology. I think in some of the questions online, it says pressure is directly related to volume, or is proportional, is directly proportional to volume. Well, it is, but it's in what? An inverse sense, which means that if the volume of the thorax increases, if the volume increases, what's the pressure inside? It decreases, right? If the volume of the thorax decreases, then the pressure increases, right? Because of that nice inverse relationship. So just be careful when you read these questions. I will always use directly related and inversely related because it's such a nice, easy concept to think about. All right, so this Boyle's Law then says that the intrapulmonary pressures occur as a result of changes in lung volume. Yeah. Oh, right here? Intrapleural versus intrapulmonary? I can't correct it right now. I'd have to go back and read the text. Yeah, so correct those notes. I have it in my notes like that, but I can't remember exactly why I had it like that. Okay. Yeah, and also intraalveolar, right, is also called the intrapulmonary. Is this the one that you're having problems? No, you're having problems with this one here, transpulmonary. So you like intrapulmonary versus minus intrapleural? Okay. What is it? Intrapulmonary minus intrapleural. Oh, okay, that is different. Oh, I don't know what's wrong. I don't know if the slide is wrong or if I'm wrong. But we could look at these numbers. Right, intrapulmonary minus intrapleural. Intrapulmonary minus intrapleural. Oh, on the board is wrong. On the slide is right, which is what you noticed. Yeah, nice. Okay. The concept still doesn't lead you astray, right? It's still the pressure difference between those two spaces. Okay, but you do want to know, realize that that transpulmonary pressure is always positive and that's always causing expansion of the lung. Okay, Boyle's Law says that pressure of a gas is inversely proportional to the volume. As long as it's a closed container, we don't take gas, we don't remove any gas or put gas in, all right? So an increase in lung volume, if the volume increases of the thoracic cavity or the lung, what happens to pressure? It decreases, right? And that causes inspiration because the pressure inside the lung is below atmospheric pressure. Atmospheric pressure is higher, so air flows in. And then to exhale, the volume of the thorax decreases, right? If the volume decreases, the pressure increases, and then that forces air out of the lungs due to Boyle's Law. Compliance is just a measure or a way of thinking of how something can change shape when a force is applied to it, a pressure, for instance. Right, so if something is highly compliant, then a small force can cause big changes in volume. Right, so again, we could compare a car tire with a balloon, and you have a sense of which one is more compliant. Yeah, a balloon. Right, a small change in pressure will make a big difference in the size of a balloon. But a small change in pressure of a car tire won't really make much of a difference in the size of that car tire. Okay. Okay. So the lungs are highly compliant. Small changes, like what we were looking at, a couple millimeters of mercury makes big changes in terms of the volume of the lungs. And then we also mentioned elasticity. There are elastic fibers around all of the alveoli, which has the tendency to collapse a lung right after it is distended. Okay. We talked about surface tension already, but I didn't mention what surface tension is due to, and I think you probably know. It has to do with those water molecules. Water molecules like to stick together, and so So that's a kind of bond. So these water molecules have a bond between them. What kind of bond is that? Yeah, just hydrogen bonds. And we're familiar with hydrogen bonds. They're weak bonds, right? So water is not solid like an ice cube when it's in a liquid form, but nonetheless, those water molecules do like to stick together. You could even think of water when it's a liquid as a liquid crystal. It has a lot of structure because of all those hydrogen bonds between all the molecules of water. And why is that surface tension significant? Well, because of the law of Laplace. It just says that if we have two different size alveoli, and if there's surface tension on the inside of these pockets right here, or alveoli, then the pressure or the air inside the smaller one would be forced into the bigger one, which means what? That the bigger one would just get bigger and bigger and bigger, and the small ones would just get smaller and smaller and smaller. And instead of having many millions of alveoli in your lungs, you would just have one big one. And that would not allow for gas exchange. So how do we get rid of that surface tension? You have some cells that line up the alveolus. Oh, and I guess I haven't shown you this one. So here is the alveolus. Here is a capillary. And here is a type 2 cell. And the job of the type 2 cell is to secrete surfactant, right, onto the inner surface of the alveolus, right? And so that disrupts the surface tension, and that allows the alveolus to expand. All right, the alveolar type 1 cell is just makes up the epithelium. It's an epithelium, and it's just a simple squamous epithelium. And the wall of the capillary is just a simple squamous epithelium. Remember, a simple squamous epithelium is specialized for exchange because it's very thin. So oxygen and carbon dioxide can diffuse across this thing that we call the respiratory membrane very easily because these cells are very, very thin. All right. When I think of the respiratory membrane, I think of actually four components that it is made up of that oxygen and CO2 have to diffuse across. Your book says three. So, I don't know, you just have to listen to the context to find out exactly what the right answer is for a particular question. Okay. So the layers of the respiratory membrane are the wall of the capillary. I agree with the textbook on that. This interstitial space, which is a basement membrane for both of these epithelia, so that's a space, and the wall of the alveolus. So a lot of people think the respiratory membrane is wall of capillary, interstitial space, and wall of the alveolus. Right, but since this is a physiology class, I'd like to incorporate one more layer, which your book mentions but doesn't include in the respiratory membrane, and that is the layer of surfactant. So don't forget about that layer of surfactant. So when oxygen diffuses from the alveolus into the blood, or CO2 from blood into the alveolus, it has to cross what? The wall of the capillary, interstitial space, wall of the alveolus, and that layer of surfactant, which allows the alveolus to expand. Okay. Mechanics of breathing, we talked a little bit about already. And we're going to go over some muscles that are really important. We learned some muscles in anatomy. Here I see an x-ray of somebody's thorax, right? When they're not breathing or when right after they have exhaled, then we don't see much of a signal from the air in the lungs. So there's a lot of x-rays that can go through the lungs because there's no tissue right there. So we can get an impression of what the size of the thoracic cavity is just by looking at this dark area. And then at the end of inspiration, right, we can then look at the volume of the lungs and superimpose what it was right after expiration. Right? And so you can see that the lungs really do get a lot bigger. The volume increases for inspiration. So here is the size of the lung originally. Here is what it is, right, after inhaling. And you can see that the volume is much bigger. All right, so if the volume is bigger in the second case over here, what can you tell me about the pressure? The pressure decreases, right? And so when the pressure decreases, then air flows down in through the trachea into the lungs, inflating the alveoli. And then for expiration, the size of the thorax goes back to its original shape like this, right? So if the volume decreases and the pressure increases, that forces air out. So that's pretty much it in a certain sense. Let's look at some muscles. But we also want to consider that there are basically two ways that we can breathe. Two different ways. There's what we call quiet breathing, which is what you're doing right now, which is not hyperventilating. And then there is deep breathing or hyperventilating. So you're moving more and more air in and out of your lungs. So these are two different ways that we can breathe. Right, and each of these have an inspiratory phase and an expiration phase. All right, so let's talk about quiet breathing, which is what you're doing right now. The most important muscle for inspiration is the diaphragm. All right, so right now you're pretty much just using your diaphragm, and that's about it for inspiration. When the diaphragm contracts, right, it moves from this large dome-shaped object, right, then to a flat object across the rib cage like this, and so that explains the increase in volume. So I'm circling that increase in volume when the diaphragm contracts. Right, that increases the volume, decreases the pressure, air flows in for quiet breathing. Now for expiration, for this kind of breathing, remember we looked at all that elastic tissue around the alveolus. The only thing that has to happen is relaxation of the diaphragm. It goes back to this dome-shaped structure. It decreases the volume of the lungs, increasing the pressure, and those elastic fibers around the alveoli force air out of the lungs. So expiration is completely passive. It means what? Doesn't require energy. But what about inspiration? Is that passive? It's not. It requires contraction of the diaphragm. Okay, that's for quiet breathing. But when we start to exercise, we need a lot more air moving in and out of our lungs, and then things change, right? Then we use some scalenes, right, and sternocleidomastoid to elevate the ribs, right? And then we can even have to use some external intercostal muscles, which again pull the ribs up and out laterally. And the same thing for the parasternal muscles, right? We'll elevate the ribs and the diaphragm contracts. So all of these muscles right here enlarge the volume of the thorax, these additional muscles, and that helps us with hyperventilation. Now when we want to exhale, when we're hyperventilating or when we're doing deep breathing, we have to utilize some muscles because just the elastic properties of the lungs won't work anymore. And so all of the abdominal muscles, when they contract, right, and decreases the size of the abdominal cavity, that forces all the abdominal organs up into the thorax, and that decreases the volume of the thorax. So all of these abdominal organs help expel air when the abdominal muscles contract. So what's a nice list of abdominal muscles that you're aware of? What are some abdominal muscles? Rectus abdominis, right? That helps us expel air when we're hyperventilating. The transverse abdominis, right? The internal oblique, external oblique, all of those muscles, right, are synergists for expiration, for deep breathing. And there are some intercostal muscles as well, right? For expiration, it's the internal intercostals, which pull the rib cage down, as opposed to the external, which pulls the rib cage up. So externals for inspiration and the internal intercostals for expiration. All right, so those are the muscles. And what can you tell me about these muscles, all these muscles, like the diaphragm, all the rectus muscles, the abdominal muscles, the abdominal muscles, intercostals, sternocleidomastoid, scalenes. What kind of muscles are those? How many kinds of muscles are you aware of? We got skeletal, smooth, cardiac. Okay. What kind of muscle are all of these? Yeah, they're skeletal. And what's a characteristic of skeletal muscle? How is it controlled? Yeah, it's voluntary, right? So all these muscles are under voluntary control, so you can control your inhalation, right? It's under your direct voluntary control. So, but a lot of times we don't think about it. We don't think about breathing when we are sleeping, for instance. So there is an automatic phase that works with these muscles, even though they're skeletal muscles. You can override that automatic function of respiration. We could all hold our breath, and we could do that experiment right now. We could all hold our breath for maybe 45 seconds, because those are all skeletal muscles right there. We can cause them to contract or not contract. And after about 40 seconds or so, what will happen? I'm holding my breath. I'm waiting for an answer. Come on. Tell me quick. Okay, I'll pass out, right? So we could hold our breath until we pass out because we have voluntary control over those muscles. But as soon as we pass out, then the automatic functions of whatever what's controlling these muscles will take over and we'll start breathing once again. Okay, so it's not like cardiac muscle, not like smooth muscle. It's really under voluntary control, but there's a certain part of the brain that controls the rhythmicity of these muscles for inhaling and exhaling. Here we have a pretty good diagram. Take a look at this diagram in your notes and pay attention to atmospheric pressure. At one point in time, there was a number in textbooks. I don't know, hopefully all of the editions of your textbooks show a different number. Here it says 769 millimeters of mercury. Right? That's not a standard number for atmospheric pressure. Okay? The standard for atmospheric pressure, and we're going to pretend that it never changes, is 760. So somebody tried to, I think, type a zero, but they hit the nine instead. Have you ever done that? Probably every day, right? That's easy to do. All right, so make sure you change that to 760. I did on the next slide, right? So here we're back where we should be. Atmospheric pressure is constant at 760. Here is the, at rest, the intrapulmonary pressure, pressure inside the lungs, it is 760. What's it in the air? 760. Right, and something's going to, that air will move from high pressure to low pressure, so what's higher, 760 inside the lungs or 760 in the air? They're exactly the same. So air is not going to move one way or the other, right, when you're just at rest. Air is not going to move into the lungs or out of the lungs. And in those conditions, the intrapleural pressure is 756, which is lower than the intrapulmonary pressure, right? So that helps, what, helps attach the lungs to the wall of the thorax, right? So the lungs are being pushed up against the wall of the thorax because that intrapleural pressure is low. Okay, on inspiration, we increase the volume by contracting the diaphragm. So the volume increases, what's going to happen to the pressure inside the lungs? It's going to decrease. And it goes from 760 to 757. Yeah, that's a nice decrease. Not much of a decrease. It's only 3 millimeters of mercury. But how would you explain that the lung is going to change shape, even with that small change in pressure? Because the lungs are highly compliant, right? Small changes in pressure can produce large changes in volume, right? And on inspiration, the pressure in that intrapleural space drops as well, right? And it's lower than the intrapulmonary pressure, and so once again, the lungs get forced up against the wall of the thorax so that they don't collapse. All right, so here we have the intrapulmonary pressure, 757, atmospheric pressure is still 760, so what's a higher pressure, 760 or 757? 760 is higher pressure, so air will flow from the atmosphere into the lungs, just down its pressure gradient. All right, and if this is just regular quiet breathing and we relax the diaphragm, right, it's going to go back to its original dome shape. It's going to decrease the size of the thorax. And if the volume decreases, what happens to pressure? Yeah, it's inversely related, so it will go up. So now we have that intrapulmonary pressure of 763. And what's atmospheric pressure? Only 760, right? So air will leave the lungs because the intrapulmonary pressure is higher than atmospheric pressure. And if you look at that intrapleural pressure once again, okay, it does change, right? But it never becomes greater than the intrapulmonary pressure. It is always lower, and that helps maintain or helps keep pushing the lungs up against the wall of the thorax so that the lung doesn't collapse. All right, so that's the mechanics of respiration. Yeah. At rest, here we are, rest, yes?
Then there is no difference between pressure inside the lung and
atmosphere. 760 and 760. Well, at this particular time, Okay, this would be maybe like right after inspiration. Okay, I tell you what, right at the end of expiration, just a normal expiration when you exhale, the pressure in your lungs is going to be the same as atmospheric pressure. Now, you can't stay like that for long because you'll have an urgency to breathe and you'll change the size of the volume of your thorax. All right, but at the end of expiration, the pressure is exactly the same. So air is not moving in or out. But I'm not sure I understand your question. Yeah. So at the end of expiration, the pressure is exactly the same, so air is not moving one way or the other. Okay. Yeah, that's exactly what happens. All right, so we actually want to take a look at some of these different volumes inside the lung, and I think that will help you understand and even explain why air is moving at certain times and not at other times. And we can do a pulmonary function test, right? So anytime you hear pulmonary, you should think of lungs. And the way that one way that we can measure the function of a lung is by using something that just measures the volume of air that's moving in and out of our lungs. And that instrument is called a spirometer. The method is called spirometry. And that's just a way to measure these different volumes. So here we have a graph. This is a good exam figure. And anytime you take a pulmonary medicine class or a physiology class, maybe even most anatomy classes, you will have this particular graph to look at. Right? So this is just a nice standard graph that you should be familiar with. And it just shows the volume of the lung, right? So here's the total volume of the lung. If we were to measure it in, what's a cc? Yeah, that's just a milliliter, right? A cubic centimeter, it's just a milliliter. All right, so what is 6,000 milliliters? That is 6 liters, basically. All right, so what is the maximum size of a normal lung? I see it right here. It's just less than 6 liters of air. Okay, that's the total capacity of a lung. Well, when we breathe in and out, right, we don't breathe in and out the maximum capacity. We don't exhale the maximum capacity, right? We inhale and exhale for quiet breathing about 500 milliliters. And so I see this variation right here going up and going down, right? And the difference between these two points is about 500 mLs. This is what we call tidal volume. Tidal volume is just the amount of air that we normally breathe in and out when we're breathing quietly. Tidal volume. Okay. But since the diaphragm is under voluntary control, right, we can perform a much stronger contraction of the diaphragm. So at the end of a normal tidal volume, if we contract the diaphragm even more strongly and incorporate some other muscles like those sternocleidomastoid, we can do what? We can really inflate our lungs maximally. When we do, we inhale much more air, and we see that goes up to the maximum lung volume. So this is what we call the inspiratory reserve volume, right? So it's the volume from the end of a normal inspiration to the total lung volume. So when we start to exercise, we can inflate our lungs a little bit more. All right, but when we're hyperventilating, maybe we want to exhale more air so that we can get more new air in. All right, so at the end of a normal tidal volume, if we exhale as much as we can, right, we can force this much air out of our lungs. Like doing what? Right, by exhaling forcefully. Right, and this is what we call the expiratory reserve volume. So this is the amount of air that from the end of expiratory reserve to the top of a inspiratory reserve, this is the amount of air that we can, under all circumstances, move in and out of the lungs, right, when we try really hard. So this is what we call the vital capacity. Vital capacity is the combination of expiratory reserve, the tidal volume, and the inspiratory reserve. So inspiratory reserve is a volume, expiratory reserve is a volume, tidal is a volume. When we add different volumes together, we get something that we call a capacity. Right? So capacity is made up of different volumes. Okay, so those are some of the ones that I really want you to know. And there's one additional one called residual volume, right? If we try really hard to force air out of our lungs, right, we go through an expiratory reserve volume, notice that there's always some air left in the lungs, no matter how hard we try to exhale. That's what we call the residual volume. And that represents the amount of air that we have no control over. It just stuck inside the lungs. Okay. As people experience lung disease, for instance, like emphysema, their tidal volume might stay the same. But the residual volume gets larger and larger and larger. So what happens to this graph? How does it shift? This residual volume gets larger and larger and larger. What happens to tidal volume? It starts to, you know what? The tidal volume stays the same, but it starts to shift up toward the top of this graph. Right? And if that lung disease progresses even further, then the residual volume gets higher and the tidal volume gets pushed closer and closer to the top. And if lung disease continues, right, then the residual volume is huge and then it starts to impinge upon the tidal volume because it can't expand past what the limit of the lung is, which is about 5.7 liters. Okay, so as we experience lung disease, the vital capacity decreases. Tidal volume might stay about the same, but the expiratory reserve, inspiratory reserve start to disappear, right? And that volume then gets transposed to become this residual volume. So somebody can't easily go from quiet breathing to forced breathing when they have pulmonary disease, right? And these different pulmonary function tests can give us an indication of how functional somebody's lung is. Okay, let's look at some things that affect gas exchange. This is a part of the respiratory system, gas exchange from one place in the body to another, like across the respiratory membrane. Well, we can think of a solution, right? A solution is just a fluid that has some dissolved particles in it, and we understand something about that solution because it's made up of a solvent and the solutes. And the solutes are just the molecules that are very small in concentration compared to the solute. And we measure the amount of solute that a solvent has. We call that the concentration, right? And these molecules will move through a fluid by diffusion. And so how will a molecule move by diffusion in a liquid, in a solution? They'll move from high concentration to low concentration, right? Okay, so, but when we think of gases, we don't talk about concentration. There's a better way of talking about it, and we talk about it in terms of partial pressure. So partial pressure will be very similar to concentration. So a molecule in a gas will move, right, from an area of high pressure, partial pressure, to that of low partial pressure. And so we want to look at all the different parts that make up a mixture of gases, right? And so think of that as almost like being a solution, but instead of concentrations of solutes, we just want to think of it in terms of pressures of these different components, right? And so Dalton's law says that the total pressure of a gas is equal to the sum of all the partial pressures of each of the individual gases put together, right? So that would be like equal to all the total concentration of something in a solution. So atmospheric pressure, remember, is about 760. What are the components in the atmosphere? Well, we have nitrogen gas, we have oxygen gas, there's carbon dioxide, and water can even evaporate, and that becomes a gas, water vapor. If we add all of these things together, it has to equal 760 millimeters of mercury, right? Because that's the measure of pressure. All right, so to get to 760 millimeters of mercury, we should know what each of these different components are. So in inspired air, right, we have, well, there's almost no carbon dioxide in the air when we breathe in. We can see it's 0.3 millimeters of mercury, right, in inspired air. Fortunately, there's a lot of oxygen, 159 millimeters of oxygen. And what is air mostly made out of? What gas is air mostly made out of? Nitrogen. Yeah, nitrogen. And nitrogen is really nice inert gas. It doesn't do much for us. only under certain circumstances are we really concerned about nitrogen. And if we add all of these things up, that's going to total 760 millimeters of mercury. And depending on the humidity, right, then the partial pressure of water increases or decreases just because of humidity. Now, the air inside an alveolus, right, that environment is a lot more humid, so water vapor contributes a lot more to the total pressure. And so, and your body is also producing CO2, so the partial pressure of CO2 increases to 40. Oxygen is being used up in your body, so the partial pressure decreases. And the amount of nitrogen changes a little bit because the pressure in this alveolus when you're neither inhaling or exhaling has got to equal atmospheric pressure, right? So if we add all of these up together, we get 760 millimeters of mercury. Okay, and that's just due to Dalton's law. So how is it that gases move from air in an alveolus to blood? It moves by a difference in partial pressure or a difference in concentration. And what do we need for a molecule to move across something? What do we need? Difference in pressure, but we need a doorway. We need a doorway, right? If there's no doorway in this room, we can't enter or leave. We're just stuck in this room, right? Same thing for these gases. They need a doorway. And what is a way that you can think of a doorway? It is a surface area, okay? I think we measured the surface area. We measured the surface area of these doors. That turned out to be, what, 2 square meters exactly. That was really handy. And so if we were to take all of these alveoli and flatten them out and put them on this table right here, how big would that table have to be to flatten out all of these all these different alveoli that are in your lung? Right? And somebody did a calculation, and it turns out to be about half of a tennis court. So it would be as wide as a tennis court. This table would have to be as wide as a tennis court and half as tall, right, if we were to take all of these alveoli and flatten them out. That would be the surface area of all of these alveoli. And what would you like to think of that surface area as? We measured it over here. Yeah, it's a doorway, right? So that's the doorway for exchange. And fortunately, all of these membranes have been folded, turned into these pockets that we call alveoli, so that huge surface area fits inside our thoracic cavity, right? So your body does that all the time. Like to get your brain, which has a huge surface area, into your cranium, what does your brain have to do? Or what has happened through evolutionary processes? Is the surface of your brain nice, flat, and smooth, or what? No, it has all those folds in it, which we call convolutions, right? So the surface of the brain is folded up so that it fits into a much smaller space. Right, so same thing for your lungs. It's all folded up so it fits in a much smaller space. And personally, I like that a lot because I can't imagine why I would like to be as wide as a tennis court and as tall as half a tennis court. It would be really hard to find clothes that would fit, right? So your lung is all folded up. So it's the same doorway for exchange. Right, so that's the job of the alveolus. Okay, the only thing missing from this slide right here, I don't see it anywhere. I see capillaries around these alveoli, but there is a protein that surrounds, there's a network of proteins that surrounds this alveolus, and as a matter of fact, all of these alveoli right here, and you should be able to tell me what kind of protein is that? What kind of fiber is that? It could be a collagen fiber, could be a reticular fiber, or it could be an elastic fiber, and you should say, oh, it's elastic fiber, right, which causes constriction of these alveoli after they inflate. That's why exhalation is a passive process for quiet breathing. Okay, pulmonary circulation. Let's think about the heart for just a second. And how many chambers does the heart have? Four. How many valves does the heart have? Four. Yes, four and four. How many sides does the heart have? it's basically got two sides. It's got a right side and a left side, right? There's a left atrium and a left ventricle, and there is a right atrium and a right ventricle. So that's important to know, because how many circulations are there in your body? There are two, right? And do you know their names? Pulmonary and systemic, right? So systemic comes from the left side of the heart, the pulmonary comes from the right side of the heart. And we know that the systemic circulation is very long, requires very high pressure to push blood through that circulation, because the length of the tube determines what the resistance to flow is. The pulmonary circulation is very short, so there's not very much resistance in those blood vessels because they're short. So there doesn't have to be as much pressure to pump blood through the pulmonary circulation. Okay. Well, because the vascular length is low, that means that the resistance and low is very low. Low pressure then is necessary to push blood through all of those capillaries, and that's a really good thing. Because as the pressure increases inside of a blood vessel, that's going to force more fluid out of a capillary. And that fluid is going to end up in the lungs. When a tissue swells up, we call that edema. So it is fortunate that the low pressure in the pulmonary circulation is very low. That avoids pulmonary edema. And as the lungs fill up with fluid, or become, when there's edema in the lungs, that means then less air can go into the alveolus, which then decreases gas exchange for you. So it's very important that there's no edema in the lungs. Now here's something kind of strange, okay? And it says here, pulmonary arterioles constrict. Remember that the resistance of a blood vessel can be changed by changing the diameter or the radius of that blood vessel. And as a matter of fact, that's the most important thing for regulating resistance in the blood vessel, or blood flow through a vessel, or flow of air through a tube, is by changing the radius. Remember, it's radius to the fourth power. And we looked at something called local control before. And let's consider the systemic circulation. Here's an arteriole that can constrict or can dilate, right? And if it's due to local control, not due to innervation by the autonomic nervous system, it's just due to the metabolism of these cells that is supplying blood, right? And so as these cells become more active, let's just say that this is a muscle and the muscle becomes active, what happens to oxygen concentration in this tissue here? It decreases, right, because the muscles use that oxygen to make ATP. When there is a decrease in oxygen, guess what happens to this arteriole? Do you think it should vasodilate or vasoconstrict to this exercising tissue? That those smooth muscles should be inhibited so that we have vasodilation, right? That vasodilation will allow more blood flow to this tissue, bringing it more oxygen, right? And it will wash out lactic acid. It will help maintain potassium at the right level outside the cell. So when these cells start to become active, potassium increases, right? But when this area becomes very active, there's less oxygen, that causes vasodilation because these tissues need more oxygen. This is for the systemic circulation. What's the other circulation that we like to make things nice and simple? The pulmonary circulation. Okay, so here we have pulmonary circulation. And one thing that you should remember about pulmonary circulation is that it is kind of opposite compared to the systemic circulation. Right? We saw that systemic is high in pressure, pulmonary is low in pressure. What about oxygen concentration in a systemic artery? Systemic artery is relatively high or relatively low in oxygen? An example would be aorta. Aorta would be high or low in oxygen? High in oxygen. And your textbooks then color that aorta, what kind of color? Like red, right? The aorta would be red, meaning high in oxygen. And then that blood flows through capillaries, the systemic capillaries, they take oxygen out, so a systemic vein is going to be, what, high or low in oxygen? Low in oxygen. And how does your book usually color code that?
Blue.
Right, so systemic arteries are red, systemic veins are blue. That signifies the change in state of oxygen. Now what about the pulmonary circulation? Okay, what about the pulmonary artery? How would you like to color that one? Blue or red? Is it high, relatively high, or relatively low in oxygen? Relatively low, so the pulmonary artery should be colored blue, which is what? Opposite compared to the systemic circulation. And since the pulmonary veins are coming back from the lungs, would they be high in oxygen or low? They're high because they picked up oxygen in the lungs, so you would color those pulmonary veins red. Right, so systemic arteries are red, pulmonary arteries are blue. And systemic veins are blue, pulmonary veins are red. They're opposite each other, right? So these two circulations pretty much are opposite to each other. And the same thing for this local control, right? So we said for systemic circulation, when this tissue becomes active and oxygen decreases, that causes vasodilation, that increases blood flow, right, to this tissue, which is bringing in oxygen to compensate for that decrease. Here is a pulmonary arteriole in your lungs. Right? And if there is an alveolus that has low oxygen in it, right, is there a reason for blood to go to that alveolus if there is little or no oxygen there? There's no good reason for it to go there, right? So when there's low oxygen in an alveolus, that causes vasoconstriction of this arteriole. How does that correspond to the systemic arteriole, right? Got low oxygen, systemic causes vasodilation. Low oxygen here causes vasoconstriction, right? So when there's vasoconstriction, reducing flow to this alveolus, then that blood can go to another alveolus that maybe has high oxygen, right? So low oxygen causes vasoconstriction, increases the resistance, blood has to go elsewhere. If there is an alveolus that is high in oxygen, right, in the pulmonary circulation, that doesn't cause vasoconstriction, that causes vasodilation, right? So increased oxygen in the lungs causes vasodilation, so that's where blood is going to go. And does that make really perfect sense to you? Because you want blood to go to an alveolus that has oxygen because the whole purpose of going to the lungs is to pick up oxygen. So the local control here is opposite, systemic and pulmonary circulations. So that, and we call that local control. That's independent of any kind of nervous intervention or hormones or anything. It's just due to the concentration of metabolites in the neighborhood around this arteriole. That's really important. Okay. And there's a condition where some people stop breathing at night. We're realizing how important that is to be diagnosed. What's that condition called? Yeah, when some people don't sleep, maybe they snore a lot, okay? Yeah, sleep apnea. So apnea means when you stop breathing, and stop breathing when you're sleeping. And so you're waking up all the time, and maybe not all the way, so you might not even notice that you're waking up all the time, but somebody with sleep apnea might wake up, oh, it could be, you know, 10, 20, 30 times every minute because they're holding their breath. All right, so when you're holding your breath, what happens to, okay, what happens to oxygen concentration in this alveolus when you stop breathing? It starts to decrease, okay? Then what happens to the resistance of this blood vessel? It increases, that's right. And then what happens to blood flow? If the resistance increases, blood flow decreases, right? Now, the blood flow through the right side of the heart and the left side have to equal each other. So how does your heart compensate when the resistance in these blood vessels in your lungs increases? It has to beat harder. It has to increase blood pressure of the pulmonary circulation. So, and it goes way above normal. What do we call above normal blood pressure? Hypertension. And you think, is that an important disease? Is that a deadly disease? Yeah, that's very serious. Okay, so when somebody has sleep apnea, decreased oxygen in an alveolus, causing vasoconstriction of arterioles in lungs, increases the resistance, so the right side of the heart, right, has to pump a lot harder. And so sleep apnea can cause failure of the heart, but not the left ventricle, but the right ventricle. All right, and another way to think of that is sleep apnea causes what? Pulmonary hypertension. Pulmonary hypertension. And also as the the pressure increases, then the lungs have a harder job of working because the edema can build up. Right? More fluid is pushed out into the lungs, and that's a very serious consequence of sleep apnea. And we're learning all kinds of strange things. Right? So that's the link between sleep apnea and pulmonary hypertension, and will lead to failure of the right side of the heart. And it's kind of difficult to measure the blood pressure in the pulmonary circulation. How would you measure blood pressure in the systemic circulation? Is that hard to measure? Blood pressure in the systemic circulation? I see somebody shaking their head. No, it's easy. How do you do that? Yeah, just a pressure cuff around the arm. Remember, all those blood vessels in your arm belong to your systemic circulation. So that's easy to measure. You go see a dentist. They probably measure your blood pressure now. Anytime you see a physician, they measure your blood pressure. But what kind of blood pressure is it? It is your systemic blood pressure. Now, what about pulmonary blood pressure? Where would you have to go? Where would you have to put that cuff? Around an artery that's deep inside your thorax, right? That can't happen. So it's really difficult to measure pulmonary hypertension. So that right side heart failure kind of sneaks up on people when they have sleep apnea. Okay. All right, so this right here is something, a mechanism that can match ventilation to perfusion, right? So blood in the lungs is going to go to an area of the lungs that is, what, high in oxygen, because that causes vasodilation, opposite compared to systemic circulation. So that's what we call ventilation-perfusion matching, because that's the way the arterioles work. If we draw out the lungs and measure what the ventilation is in various parts of the lung, ventilation is just the volume of air per minute that is moving in and out of the lungs, measure it at the apex, measure it at the base, we see that ventilation increases as we go from apex to base. And that has something to do with the structure of the alveoli. The alveoli at the base are a little bit bigger. They're a little bit easier to inflate compared to the apex. Right? So ventilation is not exactly constant. So there's more oxygen down at the base compared to the apex. So what would you think about blood flow? Where is blood flow going to go? More oxygen at the base compared to the apex, so more blood is going to flow down to the base as a result of local control. And if you're standing up, more blood will go down to the base because gravity is going to just pull blood down to that area of the lungs. All right, so we can measure blood flow to these different areas. So we see, blood flow definitely increases when we go from apex to base. Ventilation increases as we go from apex to base. But what we're really interested in is, what's the relationship between ventilation and blood flow? How are they coupled together? Right? Because we want them to match up. We want blood to go to the area of the lung that has oxygen. And let's look at that ratio between ventilation and blood flow. And we can see that the ratio is high at the apex. And what about the base? It's a lot lower. Okay. And so we don't have perfect matching of ventilation to perfusion across the whole lung, right? So the top of the lung is overventilated or underperfused, even with this local control mechanism operating, and the base of the lung is overperfused and underventilated as a result of that, right? But overall, right, if the lung is healthy, then we can maintain proper oxygen concentration. But if there's any kind of lung disease, like asthma, emphysema, pneumonia, any kind of disease process that disrupts these ventilation-perfusion ratios, and it makes it a lot harder for somebody to breathe. Okay? All right, so that's the important thing there. Control of ventilation. All right, so ventilation is relying on skeletal muscles, and of course, we can hold our breath or we can hyperventilate just by voluntarily thinking about it. But when we sleep, we don't have to think about it every time. There's an automatic function that controls, right? And it's controlled by some respiratory centers. Respiratory centers are in the brainstem, just like the cardioregulatory center, vasomotor center, are in the pons and the medulla. And here are three areas that help control ventilation. And I drew it here on the board to help describe a little bit what's going on. We have a rhythmicity center, and there's some different compartments within the rhythmicity center. There are neurons that are important for expiration, right? So when they conduct action potentials, that causes expiration. There are neurons, when they have action potentials, will cause inspiration. So that's what EX and IN stand for. Expiration, inspiration. And these things exhibit autorhythmicity. What was another tissue that you saw have autorhythmicity? Yeah, the heart has the SA node, right? It spontaneously depolarizes, and the rate can be adjusted by the parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system. All right, well, the same thing for these kinds of neurons in the rhythmicity center. Okay, their rate of depolarization can be changed by a number of things, right, to influence not only the rate of inspiration, right, but also the depth. Right, so it's the depth and rate of inspiration and expiration. So these two are sort of like antagonistic to each other, right? These expiratory neurons and inspiratory neurons. So that's the rhythmicity center in the medulla. It's influenced by a couple other centers in the pons, right? The apneustic center is excitatory, right? It increases the rate of inspiration. So that is the excitatory center, apneustic. The pneumotactic center, which is a little bit more cranial, inhibits the apneustic center, so that decreases the rate of inspiration. All right, so the pacemaker cells are in this rhythmicity center, and then these other two centers can adjust the rate of the rhythmicity center, expiratory and inspiratory neurons. So there are a lot of things then that can influence the pneumotaxic and apneustic center. For instance, like the concentration of gases, the amount of oxygen in your body, the pH of your body, carbon dioxide, will then automatically affect this automatic function of breathing. Okay, this also says that if there is disease in the brainstem, what is one way somebody could have a brain disease? What's one form of brain disease? It's terrible if somebody has this. What happens? Can do you ever have see somebody that where a part of their brain actually dies? What's that called? How about stroke? Yeah, stroke is like a heart attack, except it's in the brain. You could consider stroke a brain attack. Right, so if there is decreased blood due to stroke to this area right here, the respiratory centers, then that's going to disrupt that automatic function of breathing. So somebody with a stroke in this area still can breathe normally, voluntarily, right? But that automatic function might disappear depending on the nature of that stroke. So it's important to know something about this automatic center right here, because if this part of their brainstem dies, for instance, then they might not be able to breathe automatically. And what kind of breathing do you do when you're asleep? Is that voluntary or automatic? That's automatic, right? So somebody with a stroke in this area, when they fall asleep, they can't breathe because every breath they take has to be voluntarily controlled. All right, so somebody that can't breathe when they're asleep, that's called Odin's curse. All right, so anybody that has to voluntarily take a breath every time they breathe, that's called Odin's curse, so that when somebody with Odin's curse wants to fall asleep, what do they have to do? They have to hook themselves up to a respirator that helps them breathe. And the respirator then just automatically, right, pressurizes and forces air in their lungs and then releases that pressure. Right? So these respiratory centers are important to know about. Inspiratory neurons stimulate the spinal motor neurons that innervate the respiratory muscles. Expiration, remember, is passive and occurs when these inspiratory neurons and muscles are inhibited. Well, I just talked about these different centers already. Okay, these different centers get information of a number of compounds in your body, like oxygen and CO2. So those things are monitored by chemoreceptors, right? So chemoreceptors can monitor chemicals, like the pressure of carbon dioxide and oxygen. There are central receptors in the medulla, and there are peripheral receptors, right? So central just means what? Central nervous system. Peripheral means everything outside the central nervous system. There are receptors in the arch of the aorta and this area right here. Remember, we had baroreceptors in these two areas, right? But now we're talking about chemoreceptors. What is this very special area, right where the common carotid bifurcates into the internal and external carotid? Huge area, because that's where you have baroreceptors, but you also have chemoreceptors for oxygen and CO2. And you can see there's a little bit of a bulge right there. This is called the, it's on the slide, it's called the carotid sinus. Okay, carotid sinus is where those receptors are. All right, so how does the central nervous system control breathing? Okay, so we have automatic breathing controlled by the rhythmicity center, right? Rhythmicity center is influenced by the pneumotaxic and apneustic center. That's going to adjust the rate and depth of inspiration, but there can be other things, right? So there can be chemoreceptors in the medulla that influence the rhythmicity center. There can be these chemoreceptors in the aorta and carotid bodies that influence the respiratory centers, and even the cerebral cortex, of course, can influence breathing, right? Because you can all hyperventilate or hold your breath, right? So the cerebral cortex, these higher centers, can influence your rate and depth of breathing. And then the medulla sends these signals down through the spinal cord for somatic motor output to skeletal muscle, for instance, like the diaphragm. So let's consider some gases and maybe pH that have an effect on ventilation. And remember, so you have chemoreceptors that can monitor oxygen and CO2. And the most important chemical in your body for regulating ventilation is not oxygen, it is carbon dioxide. And I don't think that's very intuitive. And the reason why is because carbon dioxide has an influence on pH, the acidity or alkalinity of your body. Right, so if we have CO2, CO2 can combine with water to make carbonic acid. Carbonic acid can dissociate into bicarbonate ion and hydrogen ion. And as hydrogen ion concentration increases, right, what happens to the acidity of your body as hydrogen ion concentration increases? What happens to pH? That's a better way of asking. The pH decreases, which means acidity increases, right? Okay, and what do you see about these arrows right here? Is it one way or two way? One way arrow or two way arrows? Two ways. All right, so that means that the Gibbs free energy of these metabolites are the same, so this reaction can go back and forth in either direction. There's no favorable direction, right? But it can go back and forth. How does it go from left to right? What will drive this reaction to the right? Okay, it's called the law of mass action or Le Chatelier's principle. So as carbon dioxide concentration increases, that will force this reaction to the right. Right? If hydrogen ion concentration increases, it will force this reaction back to the left. Remember that law of mass action? So as our body produces CO2, right, it's converted into carbonic acid, which then dissociates into bicarbonate and hydrogen ion. So if we hold our breath, carbon dioxide will increase, right? What's going to happen to the acidity of our body if we hold our breath? It will. The acidity will increase. The pH will decrease. We'll become more acidotic, right? That would be called a respiratory acidosis. And what happens if we were to hyperventilate? When we hyperventilate, we get rid of a lot of CO2, and because of Le Chatelier's principle, bicarbonate will combine with hydrogen ions, right, and try to replace that CO2. So what happens to the pH of your body when you hyperventilate? The pH increases, right? It becomes more basic because you're getting rid of this hydrogen ion. So ventilation helps control the pH of our body. And of course, we can manipulate that just by hyperventilating voluntarily or holding our breath voluntarily. But you should definitely know the name of the enzyme that speeds up the rate of this chemical reaction. It doesn't change the energy. There's no energy change right here, right? But you still need an enzyme to speed up the rate of this reaction, right? Because that's what an enzyme does, speeds up the rate of that reaction. What's the name of that enzyme? Yeah, we looked at that already. That's carbonic anhydrase. Okay. So it helps the interconversion very rapidly. So what are the effects on ventilation with carbon dioxide and pH? Well, if we decrease ventilation, that increases CO2, right? CO2 builds up in our body, and as CO2 builds up, what happens to pH? It decreases, right? We become more acidic because carbonic acid is being produced. There are chemoreceptors in the aorta and the carotid bodies that sense that decrease or increase in acidity in the body. They send signals to the respiratory center. Respiratory center then compares that to the set point, makes a decision to increase ventilation, send signals down. So here's the efferent pathway down the spinal cord to respiratory muscles, which increase ventilation. Right, so that's increasing ventilation will decrease CO2. That's the response. How does that response correspond to the stimulus, which was a increase in CO2? It subtracts, so that's a nice negative feedback mechanism. Okay, increase arterial carbon dioxide increases plasma CO2 in the blood, and that CO2 can enter the brain. It can go through the blood-brain barrier. And when it does get into the brain, because of Le Chatelier's principle and carbonic anhydrase in the brain, that decreases the pH in the brain. There are chemoreceptors in the respiratory centers, right, in the medulla oblongata, and it will recognize that the pH is dropping, will make a decision on what? To increase respiration, increase ventilation, and that will subtract, again, from that initial stimulus. All right, so here are two mechanisms that maintain homeostasis due to central chemoreceptors and peripheral chemoreceptors, specifically for carbon dioxide. And carbon dioxide indirectly has an effect on pH. So we need to look at the brain in just a little bit more detail. The brain chemoreceptors are most responsible for changing the rate of ventilation. Hydrogen ion or acid can't get across the blood-brain barrier, right? Because it's a polar molecule, can't get across the blood-brain barrier. But CO2 can diffuse very rapidly, very easily, right? Which is why carbon dioxide is monitored in the brain and not the pH, right? So the rate and depth of ventilation is adjusted by the respiratory centers to maintain about 40 millimeters of mercury. Right. The peripheral chemoreceptors don't respond much to carbon dioxide, but the central receptors do. So here is a pretty important figure. Got some questions at the end of the chapter. All right, so here you have carbon dioxide in the blood. It can move, it can diffuse through the blood-brain barrier and the capillaries very easily. It can get into the cerebral spinal fluid, and when it gets into the cerebral spinal fluid, it gets converted into carbonic acid, which dissociates into hydrogen ions and bicarbonate. And then these neurons in the medulla can sense the level of hydrogen ions, right, which is a signal that CO2 is increasing. All right, so what's having a direct effect on ventilation? Is it CO2 or is it hydrogen ion? Okay, so hydrogen ion has the primary effect on these chemoreceptors. Right, so that's the direct effect, right? The indirect effect is increasing CO2, but remember, hydrogen ion can't get across the blood-brain barrier, only CO2 can. So CO2 has an indirect effect on increasing ventilation, right? The direct effect is due to this hydrogen ion. Take a look at this graph to kind of underscore which has a more important effect on ventilation? If it is carbon dioxide or is it oxygen? All right, so what do we have? What do we got to look at? First, we got to look at the axes. And I think it's time to go. All right, but here we have some changes in CO2 and oxygen. Which graph looks like it's changing the most? Is it oxygen or is it CO2? Which one is changing the most? Yeah, CO2. That's pretty obvious when we look at this. So we're going to talk about this, right, when we come back on Tuesday. This graph right here.